Good afternoon, everyone. This is Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What I Tell My Patients, New Treatments and Clinical Trials in Oncology. Today, we're going to be focused on urothelial bladder cancer. This is an NCPD webinar series that's done in partnership with the 2023 ONS Congress. We have a great faculty today, Ms. Brenda Martone, a nurse practitioner from Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, and Dr. Jonathan Rosenberg from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. If you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of those as we have time. We're putting out a quick one-minute survey, sort of a pretest and a post-test for this hour. If you take it, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting. We'll learn a little bit about you. We're getting ready to head out to Brenda's hometown of Chicago for the annual ASCO meeting. We're doing 9 programs out there starting a week from Friday, June the 2nd, around 11:45. All the programs that we're doing at ASCO will be simulcast virtually, so you want to check it out if you're not at ASCO this year. We're following up with lung cancer Friday night, Saturday morning about biliary cancers, Saturday night prostate cancer and ovarian cancer, then our heme session with lymphoma, leukemia, myeloma. And we're going to do a bladder cancer program at ASCO as well. Breast cancer on Monday night, June the 5th, and we'll finish out with another GU cancer, renal cell cancer, on Tuesday, June the 6th in the morning. Well, this is the other webinar we're going to be doing as a follow-up to the ONS meeting, looking at GI cancers. That'll be on June the 14th with Dr. Siamber and Ms. Wagner. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars in their car while they're working out. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program we did on bladder cancer. This was our schedule at ONS a couple weeks ago. We were pretty busy there, had a lot of fun, a lot of people attending, as always. And as we've done the last 15 years at ONS, our themes were A, clinical research update. And that's what we're doing here today with bladder cancer. What's happened, particularly in the last year, in the field, and specifically today we'll talk about bladder cancer and what are some of the key things your patients are going to want to know about some of the new therapies that are available and what's the patient education that sort of relates to that. We always have the nurses present cases from their practices in our programs, and Brenda's going to present several from her practice, and there sort of leads into the other themes that we have. The bond that heals, the fact how much patients value the relationship that they have with you, and really just to take a moment and say to nurses who are oncology nurses, thank you very much. People really value what you do. You do a great job. So the other theme, and we'll get into this with Brenda's cases, is why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient with the same oncology situation, but a different biopsychosocial social setting, different attitude, different comorbidities, age, social status, et cetera. And that should become evident as we talk about these cases today. We're going to sort of follow the natural history of bladder cancer and talk about first localized disease, both so-called non-muscle invasive as well as muscle invasive. And then we'll focus a lot of our attention, as we do in general in our programs, on metastatic disease, and get into particularly sequencing of the various therapies. And there are a number, like in many tumors nowadays, available in bladder cancer. So here's where we're heading in terms of our first discussion of localized disease. But before we do, I just want to take a step back and start with you, Jonathan. I know both of you have been involved with GU oncology for a while. We know that about 30% of our audience has been in oncology less than 10 years. So they don't really necessarily realize how different things are today than they were even 5 years ago. Jonathan, can you kind of paint a little bit of a picture? It used to be that I really dreaded talking about bladder cancer because we had nothing to talk about. Now in an hour, we can barely kind of even begin to cover it. What's it been like to see this happen, Jonathan?
It's been an amazing change. From the start of my career until 2016, we really only had one line of therapy, platinum-based chemotherapy, that would extend survival, either in the preoperative or metastatic stage. So now we have up to 4 lines and probably be 5 lines in certain circumstances. And people are living longer and living so much better, even with the toxicities of treatment.
Brenda, what's been your perspective on this? It's funny, we were doing a webinar last night, and I put up a quote. I don't know if you know Sandy Srinivas, Jonathan, from Stanford. She's a GU oncologist. I was working with her last week, and she sort of casually said, back in the day in 2019, and I'm like, yeah, 2019 was back in the day. Brenda, what's it been like for you as a nurse practitioner seeing this going on in bladder cancer?
Well, as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, we really didn't have many options. And if you looked at a timeline, it was, you know, single agent chemo and then maybe mixing some things up. And, you know, we really weren't getting what we were seeing. And I often remember going to GU ASCO and nobody would stay for the, well, some people would stay for the bladder cancer session, but there wasn't anything really new and exciting. But now, I mean, I would say maybe since 2016, things have like basically exploded with treatment options and different therapies and looking at combinations. And so now I have seen people who have been treated with some of these checkpoint inhibitors that essentially are 5 years out from treatment who haven't recurred. So I mean, I'm not saying these things are curative intent, but people are certainly living much longer and good quality of lives with these newer treatments.
I have 10-year survivors with metastatic disease, which I had not experienced in my career before that. That's really unbelievable.
Yeah, and you start to see this. You see this in lung cancer, et cetera. But let's not give you the wrong impression. This is a tough disease today. There's a lot more research going on, a lot more new agents, but still, it is a rough disease to go through. And I guess the other thing, Brenda, is this is one of the most difficult primary surgeries. We're about to talk about localized disease, but radical cystectomy is one of the most difficult cancer operations to get through. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but any initial comments, Brenda, on getting patients through cystectomy?
It takes a lot of teamwork and a lot of support and a lot of patient education. A lot of things have happened to them very quickly. And so just sort of preparing them and then being there for them so they can adapt to either the neobladder or the ostomy. And I think the biggest thing is just being honest with patients and laying out realistic expectations prior to the procedure and what to expect for the recovery. That does ensure some sense of, you know, comfort and some sort of, you know, expectations so they don't feel like they're missing things or they're not doing as well as someone else.
So, Jonathan, maybe you can sort of paint a picture for us a little bit about how patients typically present with bladder cancer, their typical demographic profile. We know that like many cancers, this is a disease that increases with age. And so a lot of these patients are older, comorbidities, et cetera. Well, like if you think about it, breast cancer presents with non-invasive disease. Here you have non-muscle invasive disease, which hopefully can be cured. And then muscle invasive disease. Can you talk a little bit about it, the typical type of patient that you encounter, how they typically present with bladder cancer, Jonathan, and then a little bit about sort of the difference between non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive?
Those are great questions. The typical, there isn't a typical patient, but it tends to be associated with smoking. It is a tobacco-related, and also although many people who get bladder cancer are former smokers rather than active smokers. And it's important for those of you who see patients who haven't been diagnosed with cancer, if there's hematuria and they're a former smoker, the item number one on the list you have to rule out is bladder cancer. Tends to be predominantly male, but women with bladder cancer are often diagnosed later and at more advanced stages because their symptoms aren't always taken as seriously, unfortunately, it feels, or they're misdiagnosed as recurrent UTIs or gynecologic issues. And so also an important point, and I find a lot of women present with more advanced disease, unfortunately. For people that do present with localized disease, just confined to the lining of the bladder, it tends to recur inside the bladder. But most of the time, it doesn't tend to spread, which is great, and that the treatments are used are often intravesical therapies as first-line treatments, such as BCG. And then later-line therapies aren't necessarily amazingly effective, but we're starting to get some really new and interesting agents that are either approved or available now, as well as
experimental. We want to talk again with the emphasis we have on new therapies. We're going to maybe emphasize these as we get into this. But Brenda, you know, the hope with non-muscle invasive disease, usually with local therapy within the bladder, is to try to get rid of it and not have to go to cystectomy. You saw a patient, I think, just a couple of days ago in your clinic. We didn't write it up because we didn't know you, but when we were talking just now, you were telling me about him, so I thought you might want to bring it up. Young patient, you know, unlike a lot of the other patients we're going to talk about today, I think he's in his 50s. What was his situation?
So he presented with gross hematuria. He hadn't been to see a primary care provider for years, so I'm not entirely sure how long this has been going on. He is 53, and he is part of a clinical trial looking at combining intravesical therapy with IV or systemic pembrolizumab, the checkpoint inhibitor, to see if we can get a synergistic and better response.
So, Jonathan, I think a lot of people have heard about BCG. I think there's also a BCG shortage. I'm curious what your thoughts are about. I think people have heard about putting chemotherapy into the bladder. Can you talk a little bit about how that's done, how effective it is? And then for patients who don't respond, what are some of the things that are being considered or being done now?
So BCG is a treatment that's been around for about 50 years. We really don't understand exactly how it works. Still, it is an immunotherapy. It stimulates an immune response in the bladder against bladder cancer. And it actually is very effective, and it's been a very difficult treatment to beat. The problem is it's hard to make, and it's hard to make in a controlled fashion such that the manufacturing process doesn't go awry somewhere. And so that's really what's led to the shortage in the U.S., as factories have had to shut down for problems. I know Merck is in the process of building, they're spending like $500 million building a new BCG manufacturing facility. And so hopefully the BCG supply will improve in a few years. And there is an effort to try to get non-US BCG strains approved in the United States, for example, the Tokyo strain, which is available in Japan, but not in the US, but seems to work just as well. And so there are trials that have done that. We're waiting to see those results. But it is a hard thing to beat. But because it's an immunotherapy, it provides a lot of interesting opportunities to combine with other treatments, such as systemic immunotherapy or other treatments that you might give inside the bladder, even chemotherapy inside the bladder.
And this patient's getting pembrolizumab, an immune checkpoint inhibitor, combined with BCG, but pembrolizumab also is approved for use in patients who have disease progression on BCG. And the idea here was, well, instead of waiting for them to progress, maybe try in this clinical trial to add it. You know, one of the advantages of being in a clinical trial, Brenda, if you think about it, this man certainly had the option of just taking BCG by itself, but he elected to try something different and, you know, something makes a lot of sense. How's he tolerating the treatment so far? Of course, with pembrolizumab and all the checkpoint inhibitors, as we're going to talk more about, and of course, during the ONS meeting, we're constantly talking about tolerability and particularly autoimmune problems. How's this man doing so far?
He's doing remarkably well and has been tolerating the intravesical BCG quite well. There can cause bladder irritation and things like that. So he's been doing very well with that, along with the pembrolizumab. And so far, he has not, I think this was cycle 2 or 3 for him. He hasn't had an immune-related reaction, but we're always looking, you know, for fatigue, rashes, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, all that stuff. But he's doing quite well with this treatment, and he's very pleased with this opportunity. And I think it also, in mentioning the clinical trial, I think when patients have opportunities like this and they're open and willing to try something new, this is where a lot of our advances come and our opportunities. So again, the fact that he was offered a clinical trial in this setting speaks volumes in terms of, you know, trying to recruit patients, trying to get a good population mix to that looks like our regular bladder cancer patients, and providing unique opportunities. So he's doing fantastic. So it's a joy to see this each time he comes for a visit. And he's getting to be close to get a repeat cystoscopy to look inside the bladder, as well as some restaging scans in June.
So hopefully he's going to have a response. Hopefully the tumor may be even completely gone, which would be great. So one of the things that we talked about a lot during the ONS meetings that we did is the potential advantages of participation in a clinical trial. And a lot of the patients that we talk about, because the nurses are nurse practitioners or at centers that have a lot of research, you see them on studies. And you know, it's not like, again, 10, 15 years ago where the studies are kind of like maybe chemo A versus chemo B. Not very exciting. Now, so many new things that can be open to patients. Really a great opportunity for them. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Jonathan, because when I first heard about this, I thought, wow, this is super cool. It's so-called TAR 200, a different way to deliver chemotherapy into the bladder. I love the nickname, the so-called pretzel. So can you describe what this pretzel is and what we know about it at this point? I think we're going to see everybody always combines everything with checkpoint inhibitors. So we're going to see, I think, at ASCO some data looking at bringing a checkpoint inhibitor with the pretzel. But what exactly is it, Jonathan?
It's a plastic tube that in the bladder sort of curls up, and it actually looks like a little pretzel. And inside of it, there is a drug, and they're using gemcitabine in this situation, but they're also going to be testing other drugs. And the nature of the tube, the material, is that the drug leaches out in a predictable fashion and provides high concentration of the drug inside the bladder over time. And so instead of, giving intravesical treatments where you give an instillation and then the patient pees it out an hour later, this stays and gives drug over the course of weeks at pretty high levels. And the results are very promising so far, I have to say, both in muscle invasive and in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Really, really interesting.
I was going to ask you before, Brenda, I know you're not, with a urology practice, but I'm curious what patients tell you about the experience of cystoscopy. Certainly that is a common procedure that patients with bladder cancer have to go through. What do they tell you in terms of how the experience?
Well, it's not their favorite procedure, that's for sure. Even despite numbing, a lot of patients are like, I have to do that again, and they're not always very excited. There are some times that if needed, we'll take them to the OR to do the exam under anesthesia, but that's probably if we're planning to take like a chunk out to check to see what's going on. But yeah, nobody's begging to have their next cystoscopy done sooner than it has to be.
Jonathan, what about patients who are, cystectomy is a big procedure. Some of these patients are, in their 80s and 90s, have a lot of comorbidities, really too dangerous to do a procedure like that. How do you manage patients like that and, so-called bladder sparing approach?
Many of the patients we see are unfortunately not terrific candidates, as you say, for a radical surgery. And so many of those patients are eligible to get chemotherapy and radiation together. The chemotherapy is used as a radiosensitizer, and radiation is administered usually external beam radiation. Sometimes people have fiducial markers placed in the tumor bed to help do image guided radiation. And radiotherapy is delivered anywhere from 4 weeks to 7 weeks, depending on the type of fractionation that's used. And about 60 to 70% of patients, depending on the stage of the tumor and how optimal a candidate they are, can have remissions. And actually, many of them are cured, probably at least half in an average population. And in an older patient who's frail, it's actually a very good option for them. And the chemotherapy has to be tailored to their medical needs. Not everyone can It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Some cytotoxic chemotherapies are too risky in those people. Others are easy to use.
So, and I think when people think about cystectomy, they think about muscle-invasive disease, but it's also used in patients with refractory non-muscle-invasive disease. And you do see patients, I mean, again, who could go through the surgery, you know, they're younger in their 50s, et cetera. Brenda, I think you were telling me about a patient you saw not too long ago who actually refused cystectomy, who are able to do it and just say, no, I'm not going to do that. And for example, with non-muscle invasive disease, that's where some of these patients can be treated with pembrolizumab. Not like everybody responding, because actually only a minority of the patients do respond, but some of them do respond. When you are you seeing patients like that, Brenda, what are some, when you're doing a follow-up visit, whether it's for non-muscle invasive or other, of a patient who's on a checkpoint inhibitor, what are some of the key things you're thinking about in terms of autoimmune toxicities? What are the common problems that you see? How do you try to identify and manage them?
So I basically tell patients when they start a checkpoint inhibitor, if they've ever had any chemo or know somebody who had chemotherapy, I kind of put all the things that they should not experience. And I let them know that the checkpoint inhibitor may cause inflammation, and it can do so in any part of the body. So I always kind of do a head-to-toe run-through. We actually have patients fill out things when they come in to kind of let us know how they're feeling, if we're seeing them live, but over the phone, obviously, you have to go through it. And I don't know how many times patients will mark no, not having a problem. But when I start asking them, okay, so everything looks great on your, you know, your sheet, and you say you're feeling good, I'm just going to ask you some follow-up questions. I'm always like, do you have dry or watery eyes? You know, are you feeling more tired than usual? Do you have a cough? Are you more short of breath? Have you had any nausea or vomiting, any diarrhea, any itchy skin? And I just kind of go through all of the major systems to see if they report something, because they may say, oh, I thought that was food poisoning or something, and it's still bothering me, but I didn't think I need to mention it. So you always have to assume there's a possibility that these things can happen, and you have to specifically sometimes ask patients, point blank, are you having this? Because they may not think it's important to report, or don't think it's something they want to be, you know, bothering someone with, or is that something that might change their therapy? So just letting them know that the sooner we find out about these things, the easier it is to manage. And we have a way to calm things down if they were to start having some immune-related event.
So let's talk a little bit now about muscle invasive disease. Again, we're going to stick with the localized theme. And Jonathan, like a lot of places in oncology, we see the use of adjuvant treatment. More recently, we've had adjuvant chemo out there for a while. Now we're starting to see adjuvant immunotherapy. We see this in other cancers, adjuvant immunotherapy, renal cell cancer, we were just talking about, for example. Lung cancer, adjuvant immunotherapy. Can you talk a little bit, Jonathan, about when a patient has either neoadjuvant treatment first or then goes right to cystectomy, how you determine whether or not you're going to recommend adjuvant treatment? In most cancers, a lot of it has to do with the risk. But what are some of the things you look for, Jonathan?
So I make the decision in a couple of ways. First of all, I look to see what I think about whether they've had preoperative chemotherapy. And if they have, and they still have cancer that's still deeply invasive, into the muscle or in lymph nodes, and they don't have any major contraindications to getting adjuvant therapy, I would offer them adjuvant nivolumab, because it's clear that those patients seem pretty clear those patients are the ones who benefit the most from adjuvant therapy. And then if someone didn't have neoadjuvant chemotherapy for whatever different reasons, and they have high-risk disease at cystectomy, which really in my mind is stage 3, meaning through the bladder wall or higher, as opposed to people who had prior chemotherapy, it's really still muscle invasive, as opposed to T2 and higher. And if they haven't had chemotherapy, T3 and higher. Those patients, if they're cisplatin eligible, I actually offer them adjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy. But if they're not cisplatin eligible, I offer them adjuvant nivolumab, or if they're refusing chemotherapy, I offer them adjuvant nivolumab. And so I risk stratify. There is some data that PD-L1 high tumors may have better outcomes than patients whose tumors are low with PD-L1, but the approval in the United States is agnostic to PD-L1 status, in contrast to Europe, where the use of adjuvant nivolumab is restricted only to PD-L1 high patients.
So, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot in oncology, particularly in bladder cancer, is cisplatin versus carboplatin. And this 77-year-old man that's your patient, Brenda, it was interesting because, you know, usually there's a preference for cisplatin. And can you talk a little bit about how, first of all, about the man and when you first encountered him, and also about his past history and how that related to the choice of chemotherapy?
Yes, of course. He was, he's now a 77-year-old. He was 76 when we first met. He presented with significant hearing loss due to serving in the military. That was one thing that made us concerned about the cisplatinum. Hearing loss is definitely a contraindication. Age-wise, he appeared fit enough, but again, because of the hearing loss, we went with the adjuvant carboplatin with GemZAR. And he did receive 4 cycles of that. He did have some issues with some neutropenia with each cycle. So after the 4 cycles, the decision was based on imaging showing a good response and no evidence of disease, and his neutropenias and the potential risk we were possibly exposing him to go ahead and transition to adjuvant nivolumab at that time.
So what's his current status and how's he doing?
He is currently without evidence of disease on imaging. He is almost a year into his adjuvant nivolumab without recurrence. He is without really any significant adverse events related to the immune checkpoint inhibitor. The only thing he reports on occasion is some itchy skin, which of course is manageable for him without a rash. So our plan is to continue with our dosing and repeat imaging at the end, just prior to when he would stop. And hopefully he's maintaining his no evidence of disease status. And then he would just go into close follow-up where we would see him frequently. And of course, with imaging, and continue to monitor him for any potential, while it's not expected, but any potential late effects that may develop related to the immune system. We always kind of keep that in the back of our minds when we're seeing people.
So, Jonathan, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the spectrum of toxicity that you see. This relates to metastatic disease that we're about to talk about in terms of checkpoint inhibitors. Some of the things I'm curious about your thoughts are on endocrine autoimmune issues, such as the thyroid, colitis in the GI tract, pneumonitis. And also whether you think, this has been a highly debated topic, you see a lot of papers, whether there's a relationship between getting autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit. You know, if you see a patient having problems, you go, oh, that's a good thing because maybe it means it's going to be working better against the cancer.
When I talk to patients about this, I start out by telling them that many patients have few or no side effects, first of all, and that it's often fairly easy therapy. About a third of patients have mild to moderate side effects, skin rashes that need either short course oral steroids or topical steroids, or some other transient self-limited autoimmunity, although there are about 20% of patients that end up with some degree of hypothyroidism. And then there are the rare but serious problems. About 10 to 15% of patients will need high-dose steroids to turn off autoimmunity. And we need them in the case of colitis or enteritis or pulmonary toxicity or hepatotoxicity. Those are, or nephritis, which is pretty rare. They're the minority of patients, and almost always we can turn the toxicity off. And I do think that there is probably an association in bladder cancer of autoimmunity on these drugs with better outcomes. It's not universal, but patients often do much better.
I do hear a lot of stories, Brenda, about dermatologic issues with checkpoint inhibitors, not just rash, but pruritus, like you were saying before. How often do you see dermatologic problems in patients with checkpoint inhibitors, and what do you usually see, and what do you do about it, Brenda?
I would say skin rashes are probably one of the most common. So basically, if it's just pruritus, topical emollients, they can maybe take some over-the-counter antihistamine if it's bothersome. If they actually have a rash, and usually it's like a macular papular rash, if they have a rash, then finding out how much of the body is covered in the rash, because that helps us kind of strategize what we would use, such as, you know, topical steroids, is it appropriate? If the rash does become concerning, because I've had patients who do develop more concerning rashes holding the checkpoint inhibitor, starting the steroids, and getting them in to see dermatology, like immediately for good evaluation and assessment. But generally, the things are self-limiting and generally well-tolerated, as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned. It's just a matter of, again, making sure you're always looking for the worst case scenario, and not finding it is always the best thing for the patient and the provider, that's for sure.
So another thing that, you know, I wouldn't doubt patients may read about this and even come in, Jonathan, is the question of, does taking antibiotics affect the efficacy of immunotherapy? Can you talk about why people even or begin to think about this, Jonathan? And do you try to limit, I'm sure you try to limit antibiotics in general, but do you think that people who get antibiotics maybe don't get as much benefit?
It's a controversial area. There is some evidence, in certain analyses, that do suggest that people who get antibiotics or are on antibiotics when they start treatment with the checkpoint inhibitor might not do as well. And there's other studies that don't support that. The idea behind it is that your microbiome is affected, and that probably has interactions with your immune system in ways that we don't totally understand. But if you change the flora in your body, you may change how the immune system interacts with the cancer. I still think if you have an infection, you need antibiotics, obviously, because the consequences can be severe or life-threatening. And so it is, you know, sometimes maybe you wait a little bit to start the checkpoint inhibitor, but I don't know that that's right either. Maybe it's just the fact that you need antibiotics is the problem, as opposed to getting the antibiotics. And so you have to take care of the patient in front of you. But there is, I would say, more than a theoretical concern, but it's not clear how important it is to me.
So we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about metastatic disease, but just to finish out on the localized, Brenda, can you reflect back on this man and what it was like to take care of him? And again, this sort of theme question we have, why was it different to take care of him compared to some other patient who's getting chemotherapy and adjuvant nivolumab?
Yeah, I think what made it really interesting is just his background and his social history. And then the fact that, he was a little bit harder to get through chemotherapy, but his wife would always come with him. And the two of them were hilarious in the exam room, because she would always be like, oh, you're not telling the truth, or you're not, you know, you're exaggerating that, or this isn't what you told me. And so she was like a good sounding board. So I would check with him, obviously, you know, may I check in with your wife? But she was actually very helpful in letting us know how he was doing. And the fact that he was so hard of hearing, even with his hearing aids, that makes for a comical little interaction, especially during COVID. There were times that the mask really was somewhat prohibitive. And so I, you know, towards the end, after everybody had been vaccinated a little bit, I would go in there and I would ask them, is it okay if I take down my mask, you know, and stay a certain distance? Because shouting at him, he would be like hearing partial parts of the question or whatever, and he would come back with some strange answer. So I think it was just the fact that he was such a lovely gentleman, but there was always humor with his visits, and just seeing how his wife and him interacted, it was always a pleasure to see them.
Interesting. Don't maybe see as much humor as we'd love to see in the clinic. Let's talk about metastatic disease. And Jonathan, actually, recently we actually had a new approval. There's so many new approvals coming out in oncology. So we talked about immunotherapy, pembrolizumab, and now we have immunotherapy combined with enfortumab vedotin as an option, first line, an antibody drug conjugate. We'll get to that exciting development in a second, but maybe you can sort of set the ground first with kind of what the last couple of years, the standard approach has been to first line therapy of metastatic disease. A lot of times these patients have had prior therapy. They may have gone through adjuvant therapy like this man, and then have to deal with a very disappointing fact that they now have recurrent and metastatic disease. In the past, Jonathan, this was treated with chemotherapy, but now we're seeing immunotherapy. Now a different checkpoint inhibitor, avelumab, used right after the chemo. So they don't wait, it's not second line, it's really maintenance therapy after that. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what led to that development, Jonathan, and how it's played out in your practice?
Patients who receive platinum-based chemotherapy for metastatic disease usually relapse within 6 to 9 months. And often at the time of relapse, they're doing very poorly and not even able to get second-line immunotherapy, which would be pembrolizumab. And so there was a large trial, the Javelin Bladder 100 study, looking at the use of maintenance of avelumab compared to just standard of care observation at the time, and showed that there was a dramatic 7-month improvement in overall survival if you started maintenance in patients who were responding to chemotherapy essentially right away, and as opposed to waiting until relapse. And that really has changed our approach over the last several years to incorporate this maintenance immunotherapy earlier in patients who have better outcomes from metastatic disease after chemotherapy. For patients who progress, though, they would receive pembrolizumab as a second-line therapy based on KEYNOTE-45, which showed that it was better than taxane chemotherapy. And so, but the problem is that plenty of patients were too sick by the time they progressed, that they just would never be able to get any treatment. And so we had adopted this pretty quickly once we saw the data. And it's been a major improvement for patients compared to just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Brenda, what's been your observations and experience with patients who go through this? You know, first the chemotherapy, but then the maintenance treatment with avelumab. How's that for the patients? They're receiving it, you know, chronically. What's it like in this situation?
So, again, since they had chemo, I always make sure very clearly when they start the maintenance avelumab, all the things that shouldn't happen. I also reassure them that they've actually completed the toughest part of their therapy, which is the chemotherapy. And they generally feel better the further they get out from the chemotherapy. The avelumab is given every 2 weeks, so it's a little intensive with the dosing. So patients are coming every 2 weeks to get their infusion. We see them every other visit, every 4 weeks, to kind of keep an eye on them. But in general, they tolerate this treatment very well. And they're quite surprised in terms of how they do compared to chemo. I actually saw a gentleman today who's been on maintenance of avelumab, and we know each other. You know, they bought me socks for Nurses Day, but him and his wife have become like part of the family. And so he goes, he's like, dude, I feel fine. If I have to do this the rest of my life, I'll do it. And so he's been tolerating things quite well without evidence of recurrence, and very pleased with what's going on in the treatment. And I'm always happy to see him and his wife.
So Jonathan, as we went through all the different cancers we were covering in the ONS meeting, there were a couple of themes that became very evident. One is the infiltration of immune therapy into oncology. So many different, not just checkpoint inhibitors, but many different types of immune therapy. We've already talked about using it in non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive, and of course, metastatic disease, but also targeted therapy. And we're going to talk later on about a classical targeted approach called erdafitinib, but also antibody drug conjugates. And we're seeing this almost, it seems like every solid tumor now, Jonathan, there are antibody drug conjugates really revolutionizing the care of cancer in general. And there are actually two antibody drug conjugates approved in bladder cancer, enfortumab vedotin and sacituzumab govitecan. The nurses here probably remember sacituzumab, which is used a lot in breast cancer. Enfortumab vedotin used in bladder cancer. You probably remember we talked in ONS about brentuximab vedotin, the same payload, so to speak. So, Jonathan, first of all, what are ADCs, antibody drug conjugates, and how do we sort of analyze how the way they're put together affects both their efficacy and tolerability?
Antibody drug conjugates are based on an antibody that binds to a cell surface molecule and uses that cell surface molecule essentially as a lock and key to get inside the cell, to unlock the cell, to get chemotherapy into the cell. And the antibody has a very potent cytotoxic attached to it. And on, for enfortumab vedotin, it's MMAE or vedotin. And for sacituzumab govitecan, it's SN38, which is the active metabolite of irinotecan. And once released inside the cancer cell, they go on to hit their targets and lead to cancer cell death. And so the idea behind it is that it sequesters a very toxic chemotherapy from the rest of the body, at least to varying degrees, and delivers it selectively to the cancer cell, allowing you to get much better cancer cell kill than you would. And certainly if you tried to give either of these drugs, for example, SN38 or MMAE, just IV into a patient, you would make them super duper ill and might even kill them. And so this is a way to give these really potent drugs. And they work. they really do. We've seen now multiple examples throughout solid tumors and now in liquid in lymphomas and in liquid tumors. They're highly active agents, many of them, not all of them.
Yeah, at the ONS meeting, we were talking about the fact that, you know, again, Hodgkin lymphoma, brentuximab, first-line therapy, part of first-line therapy now for Hodgkin with chemotherapy. And also in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, one of the most common non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, now just approved another antibody drug conjugate, polatuzumab, combined with R-CHOP chemotherapy was better, or R-CHIP, than R-CHOP alone. So many different cancers moving up earlier and earlier. Brenda, I'm curious how you explain to a patient getting enfortumab or sacituzumab. You know, Jonathan just went through the sort of medical explanation. How do you explain it to a patient?
I tell the patients that they're looking for a protein that sits on the bladder cancer cells, depending on which drug body conjugate they're getting. That protein is also expressed in some normal cells. So when I go through the potential side effects, they can kind of put two and two together. But I basically tell them that the medicine is looking for this protein that sits on top of the surface like an antenna, and it attaches to it and then inserts the chemotherapy directly into the bladder cancer cell.
So, Jonathan, we were saying actually last month, it's May, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Losing track of time here. Anyhow, just April 3rd, we saw the actual approval in the first line setting. We were talking about eligibility for cisplatin in terms of hearing capabilities as well as renal function and how many of these patients are not eligible to get cisplatin. And in a way, it's kind of similar to what we were talking about before when we said chemotherapy and then maintenance rather than waiting second line. Here, you're getting what would be the second line therapy, pembrolizumab, with the third line therapy, enfortumab. They're not eligible to receive cisplatin. And Jonathan, maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know about the combination. It hasn't been used in thousands of patients, but we talked about what a waterfall plot is. Each one of these bars is a patient, and the tumor size is reflected. If it increases, the bar goes up. If it decreases, it goes down. And you can see this is the kind of waterfall plot you like to see. Almost all the patients, the tumors are shrinking. So what's the bottom line about what we know about this regimen, Jonathan? And is this something that you're using in your practice?
This is a very active regimen in untreated metastatic cisplatin-ineligible bladder cancer patients. This treatment leads to regression in over 95% of patients and leads to responses in at least two-thirds of patients, and about 10 to 15% of patients have complete responses. And it's looks like it's doubled the progression-free survival compared to historical data with gemcitabine carboplatin, and doubled the overall survival compared to historical data with gemcitabine and carboplatin. Now, these are single-arm studies. This is cohort A. This was the first data that was reported showing the 73% objective response rate. This was followed up by a randomized cohort, cohort K, looking to understand what did enfortumab do in this patient population by itself, and what did the combination do. And so that combination, that cohort, the data was reported at ESMO last year with a response rate of 64.5%, with a similar, the fact that the duration of response hasn't been reached, with similar trends towards long OS and PFS. But, you know, some more toxicities, certainly, than you might get with either enfortumab or pembro alone. But the dramatic responses and the long-term durability look like they are going to win the day. This is cohort K. This was this confirmatory cohort. And you see the numbers here, and the FDA approved it, and they aggregated actually cohort A and cohort K data to come up with a 68% response rate. And again, we think gemcitabine and carboplatin has a 35 to 40% response rate, progression-free survival of 6 months. This has 12 months and 68%. It's really qualitatively different. But here you see the toxicities. There's more skin reactions in the combination. And skin reactions with enfortumab vedotin very occasionally can be really serious. About 1% of patients can have really bad skin reactions, like Stevens-Johnson, and even as bad as TEN. But you know, my general approach to mitigate that is actually to see the patients frequently at the beginning of treatment. I think there's a temptation to see them once a cycle. I see them the first week, the second week. I don't see them on their off week unless there's a problem. But we see them every week, certainly at the beginning of treatment, because you can often see these things developing and hold doses or reduce the dose, still not compromise efficacy very much, and maybe abort some of these most serious toxicities.
So, Brenda, of course, we have a lot of experience with enfortumab vedotin by itself in the metastatic setting, and now we're starting to see patients get both immunotherapy as well as enfortumab together. But what have you observed in general? Jonathan talked about skin issues, also peripheral neuropathy, ocular disorders. We're seeing more and more ophthalmic disorders, particularly with antibody-drug conjugates. So you see it also with erdafitinib that we were talking about, hyperglycemia and infusion-related reactions. What are some of the things you've observed, Brendan? Generally, what's the quality of life of these patients?
So the quality of life is variable. I think I agree with Dr. Rosenberg, seeing people frequently. We often see them day 1, 8, and 15 at the beginning for close monitoring. And there's a great benefit to identifying something sooner rather than later. In general, we can see peripheral neuropathies. Now, in speaking in the frontline metastatic setting, they may not have been so heavily pretreated as those that we see, you know, who are using enfortumab, vedotin, or sacituzumab in later lines of therapy. So they may not have coming in with baseline peripheral neuropathies, but always asking them, you know, can you button your buttons, zip your zippers, you know, hold a pencil, you know, and actually asking them, and then also paying attention to what clothes they wear to the visit. Sometimes, you know, you can see a lot if somebody used to come in shirts that were buttoned and now they're wearing sweatshirts and things like that. Mm-hmm. So sometimes just a good, you know, that can be a good indicator of what's going on. The skin reactions can be quite severe. And again, I've seen all sorts of reactions. A lot of times it looks like it's erythema, but it's more confluent and not like a rash sometimes. And I can see it develop in a lot of the skin folds. So I'm always looking under the axilla, in the folds of the, you know, the arms, the legs, even in the groin. And sometimes it can almost look like it's like a post-inflammatory reaction. And there can even be like some skin. I've seen skin peeling with this too, like a sunburn. And so obviously holding doses and examining the skin all over is important with each visit. And then, you know, making sure their fatigue is manageable, keeping a close eye on their labs. You certainly want to be looking for that elevated glucose. And just making sure that you have your other providers in place if needed, like you have derm available if needed, ophthalmology available if needed, you know, just so you have a quick and easy way to add care providers to the patient's team to help manage and mitigate some of these side effects.
So I think peripheral neuropathy, we were talking about Hodgkin before, you know, that clearly there it's been not a different drug, but similar issue that seems to be get better when you stop the drug. Jonathan, any more comments about tolerability, particularly the ocular issues? We did an entire program just on ophthalmic issues in oncology recently, and there are a lot of drugs that cause eye issues. What exactly do you see with enfortumab? And also, we were talking about hyperglycemia. Can you give it to a patient who's a diabetic on insulin, for example?
All good questions. The ocular disorders tend to be more dry eye or watery eyes, which is often a symptom of dry eye syndrome. There usually aren't serious corneal issues with enfortumab, although they can occur. And so I often have people using refresh tears, and if that doesn't help, then send them to the ophthalmologist, clearly. Hyperglycemia is an interesting thing. Always pay attention to it at baseline, and we check a glucose every time they're coming in to get treatment. And if you start to notice a trend going up, you need to pay attention to that. They don't have to do a fasting glucose each time. I tend to not give it if the A1C is over 7 until I get it under control. It doesn't matter so much if they're on insulin or not, but it's the control that matters. I think there's an insulin resistance issue that can develop while on treatment, but I'm not 100% convinced that there's anything I can do pre-treatment to figure that out, other than what I just said, looking at baseline A1C and looking at their blood sugars weekly.
You know, we're seeing more and more combinations of antibody-drug conjugates with immunotherapy. I mentioned some examples before. And if you think about it, it's kind of like giving chemo plus immunotherapy, which you do every day in lung cancer, right? We give the chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab, for example. But in terms of these patients, in terms of that, I'm curious, Brenda, when you see patients who are getting this, do you think there's a synergy toxicity-wise, or is it like you have the enfortumab toxicity, you have the IO toxicity? Jonathan, I guess the studies didn't really seem to, you would think that maybe one would make the other worse. I don't think we've seen that in the trials. Brenda, is it really 1+1 here from what you've seen?
With all the experience with checkpoint inhibitors and knowing what that rash looks like and knowing what a rash related to a drug body conjugate looks like, they're pretty distinct. So I'm going to say in general, you can pretty much know what one is causing the other. In terms of like immune related peripheral neuropathies, they're pretty uncommon. And given what we know about enfortumab being so great at causing peripheral neuropathies, I think you can pretty much figure out which one. If you're ever unsure, and it's not glaring, I don't know what Dr. Rosenberg would say, but it's probably from the EV and not the Pembro in terms of what we're looking for. I do know that I've learned too over the years in taking care of, I mean, the combo's new, but in taking care of patients with enfortumab vedotin, knowing when to respect that side effect and symptom and not pushing patients, because we do know that with dose reductions, those side effects can improve and the efficacy isn't compromised. I think earlier on, we had patients that we pushed a little, and their peripheral neuropathies actually stayed grade 2 and never really improved with some of that pushing. So I think it's important to respect the drug, respect the side effects, and know that a dose reduction doesn't mean you're going to take away the potential benefit. And explaining that in a way to the patient is also important, because nobody wants their dose reduced. They want the strongest and the best. But, you know, I always tell them, for the person sitting in front of me, you know, the clinical trial showed that. But, you know, this is targeted. And so we need to figure out the dose for you, for this particular person, this patient in front of me. And maybe that's not that dose. And maybe a lower dose would be better. And so I think it just kind of tones in or kind of targets the patient-related specific therapy for that patient. You can kind of spin it like that a little bit, just to let them know that we're picking out the right therapy for them. We just have to make sure we're giving them the correct dose.
That was really a beautiful description of it, really the art of oncology. Jonathan, anything you want to add to that? And also in terms of the issue of using enfortumab and Pembro together, again, do you think it's sort of one plus one? Each one has their own different toxicity issues, and they don't make each other worse, so to speak?
I would agree. I actually agree with everything that Brenda said. What I would add to that is they both can cause pneumonitis, although the rate is very low and probably higher than you might expect with either one alone, but it's still a very low rate, under about 5% or less. The neuropathy is EV, 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 unless for really weird circumstances. I also, you know, I have a few patients who had developed pretty significant neuropathy that they needed to just stop treatment, but they also were responding really well. And one of them is a year and a half off treatment without any progression or recurrence. And another one is almost 2 years off treatment without any progression. And in fact, I did a Natera test, a Signatera DNA, circulating tumor DNA test, and it's negative in that patient, which is, I don't know that they're cured or anything, but it is reassuring that there are some patients where you can stop and they slowly get better with the neuropathy, or they adapt. And it's a really, it's a drug that's just different than what other things we've had at this point.
Well, let's hear about a patient who actually got this new therapy, I think, right after it was approved. I love hearing stories like that. You know, the drug gets approved, the next day patient benefits, or regimen gets approved by it. I guess this man was interesting, that initially he had surgery with the hope that he was going to be cured. But when they went in there, you were telling me, Brenda, they found all kinds of peritoneal mets. So he had had neoadjuvant chemotherapy already, but now they found he had metastatic disease. He was put on this combination of Pembro and Fortimab. How did he do? How is he doing?
So overall, no immune-related side effects to date, which is great. He is. He did kind of come in with some baseline peripheral neuropathies from the neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So we're keeping a close eye on them. I saw him last week, and he had grade 2 peripheral neuropathies, kind of tingling and pins and needles in his feet. And it was really bothersome to him. And so much that he was like, well, maybe I should hold one of the drugs, or maybe not get so intensive therapy. And I asked him, you know, well, why don't we reduce the dose of the enfortumab and let's see how things go? It wasn't significant enough that we needed to hold. And I certainly didn't want to change a treatment based on one report of, you know, maybe worsening peripheral neuropathies. So I dose reduced him. He got his Pembro, and then he came back today, and his peripheral neuropathies, they're not any better, but they're also not any worse. So I think he's stable overall, and he'll be coming up for some imaging shortly, which I'm hopeful that it will show that he's getting a good response, especially since it was kind of a big shock for him to go to surgery with curative intent, and then to find out that the operation had to be aborted because there was, metastatic disease that wasn't seen on scans, obviously. So he's doing well. He lives with his sister, who also is involved in his care. And sometimes we were chatting earlier, but I kind of mentioned to you before that it's somewhat difficult sometimes because it looks like they're both using his MyChart to send messages. And so sometimes you can get conflicting messages on the same day. And so that's where you've got to kind of pick up the phone. But I think she's pretty much kind of doing a mothering role, and they also do live together. So, you have to be careful with that MyChart sometimes, just to double check who's actually sending the message and making sure you don't forget to go call the patient and be like, hey, I just wanted to follow up on this, because you can get much better information when you're actually talking on the phone than sometimes in those patient portals.
I love hearing your case descriptions. I think it would make a great TV series. Let's just finish out with a few things that are kind of new. One, Jonathan, we have actually another antibody drug conjugate that we talked about before, sacituzumab, often used after enfortumab. Anything you want to say about, again, a lot of nurses have experience with SASE in breast cancer in terms of the typical tolerability issues that come up with this drug, Jonathan?
It's not that different in bladder cancer. You get GI toxicity, diarrhea, cramping, cytopenias, and fatigue. And those tend to be the most prominent things that that we see in GU cancer, in bladder cancer. So it's often really well tolerated, except for people often need growth factors. There's a risk of neutropenic infection, but it doesn't give you peripheral neuropathy. And so it's often a good option for patients in this setting, because they, it's a non-cross-resistant toxicity profile, essentially, from the prior therapies.
So a couple other agents that are used in bladder cancer, we could talk a lot more about it, but just to kind of profile a little bit, of course, in the ONS meeting, we talked about so many different targeted therapies, particularly in lung cancer. Jonathan, what's erdafitinib? What's it targeting, and how do you use it?
Erdafitinib is an oral medication. It is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, inhibits the FGFR family of kinases. And it's indicated in patients who have an FGFR 2 or 3 alteration and who have progressed after platinum-based chemotherapy or chemotherapy followed by immunotherapy. It has a response rate of about 40%. It's present in about 15 to 20% of metastatic disease patients and about 60%, 70% of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The drug itself causes hyperphosphatemia, it causes stomatitis, it causes retinal pigmented epithelial detachment, which is reversible, like MEK inhibitors. And so it can cause your fingernails to kind of fall off. It's not the easiest drug to give, I find personally, but it can be highly active, and we'll hopefully see the results from the randomized phase 3 trial at ASCO if they present the late-breaking abstract comparing it to taxanes in the refractory setting.
So we always know when there's a big trial at ASCO that it may be followed by a lot of usage. Any comments on your experience with this drug in terms of tolerability issues? As Jonathan was saying, a lot of sort of weird, unusual things. Brenda, what's the thing that sort of sticks in your mind the most about this drug?
I would say the close follow-up to look for ophthalmic changes, and also the skin toxicities and the mucositis. Again, because it is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, we're all pretty aware of those kind of side effects that we see. And so just trying to stay on top of that for patients to help minimize that and give them the supportive care that they need. It is a tough therapy. It's not easy. And where it's currently approved, the patients have seen prior therapy. So you know, depending on your patient and their performance status and what other prior therapies they've got and the toxicities that they're bringing with them, this can be a harder treatment to manage, but I think it just needs close follow-up, seeing patients in clinic, identifying things early to help intervene is the best kind of approach with this.
So Brenda and Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. I think we all learned a lot. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back a week from Friday. We start our wild ASCO trip. You can join us virtually or come over into the Hilton Hotel in Chicago. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Brenda. Thanks, Jonathan.